Welcome, welcome, welcome. This week's Distraction Pieces podcast is episode 188. And I'm joined by Florence Pugh, who I was delighted to line up a conversation with. We chatted on Twitter a little bit. I'm a fan of Lady Macbeth. I thought it was fantastic. And I didn't really go into this, but I'm really excited about her we go into the film. I just didn't go into my excitement about her upcoming film, Fighting With My Family, because I'm a big wrestling fan, as many of you will know, and I'm a big Stephen Merchant fan, and I'm a big fan of The Rock, so all these people involved in it. I'm a big Nick Frost fan. He's previously been on the podcast, if you want to listen to that. I'm a big Lena Headey fan. She's previously been on the podcast, if you want to check that out. So everyone involved in this excites me hugely. So yeah, I sat down with Florence. She's probably posted a picture on social media of the scene that greeted her, because I've got my recording equipment, and cheaper than renting out a studio is renting out a cheap hotel room that looks all scummy and poorly lit. So poor Florence arrives, and there's mics everywhere. It's this old, weird-looking room. I happen to be dressed typically gothic and miserable, so as soon as she walked in, she laughed out loud and said, "I've got to take a picture of this before we get going." So she will have probably posted that on social media. Also, Florence and Guz Khan, which was three episodes ago, are current contenders for Polaroid of the Year, possibly Polaroid of all time. Frank Carter, when I had him on, he had a really good Polaroid, but the face that Florence pulled in the Polaroid, and you only get one chance, was just wondrous. So have a look at the Polaroid on your phone now. Do it now. Thank you. And yeah, if you want to listen to more amazing actors, you could check out last week's episode with Vicky McClure, or previous episodes with Michaela Cole, Kathy Burke, Susan Wacoma, Georgia Campbell, loads of really good people. Chris Fairbank, who we talk about in this podcast. The thing I need to tell you at the beginning here is that I need you all to go and swoop as a team. The merch I've got at speechdevelopmentrecords.com, which is where you can buy merch and support the podcast. The first three loads of podcast merch was all based around Team 3W, which is what you guys called yourselves and I called you guys when we started this podcast off, because I say a welcome, welcome, welcome. And I used to say that on my radio show. And I made it a team because you guys are amazingly supportive. And when I've had podcasts that are about calls or that have any kind of call to action, you tend to swoop in huge numbers and actually be active rather than passive and just listen. So what I want you all to do is go over to the BAFTA website and go to the EE Rising Star, which is a public vote, which Florence Pugh is up for. And Florence kindly in the podcast says, just go and vote for anyone, like who you think is best, which is good advice. I don't have to be a nice, humble person on her behalf. So I think you should just go straight now and vote for Florence, because Lady Macbeth was in my films of the year. It's amazing. And yeah, this is one of my favourite podcast chats that I've had. So hope you enjoy it. I'll be back at the end with a little bit more information and rambling, but until then, this is episode 188 of the Traction Pieces podcast with Florence Pugh. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. It is. I almost started a mid-sentence, which is the traditional podcast method of, oh, we're just having a casual chat.
We were just actually chatting about chai latte.
But we were just having a casual chat. So I'm joined by Florence Pugh. How are
Hello.
You today?
Good, thank you.
We'll get into everything. I've made some notes and stuff. But you were just talking, or we were both just talking about how weird it is that you end up doing promo runs for things a long time after.
Years
like
later.
Two projects after, at least. I think you did three projects last year, maybe.
Yeah.
So. That's all since Lady Macbeth, which is getting a lot of love now. And you're just starting another project. Mm-hmm. So how weird is that to kind of have that time period? Do you think it's a good or bad thing?
Well, as I was just saying to you now, I don't know if it's too awful, because when you're doing it, the most kind of like bizarre, wacky things are actually quite normal.
Yeah.
And I was just about to explain that. I remember when we started filming Lady Macbeth, the first week in, it started and it did not stop until we had one day off that Sunday. And I remember, because it was just a short budget and I was going to Durham, and it was just for quite like a lengthy time of not knowing whether this project was anything, you know, massive. I remember I called my mum after the on Saturday just to let her know it was all right, and she had questions about just how filming is, as you do. And she was like, so go on, then what was the most exciting day? And I was like, well, I don't know, I'm just filming. She was like, yeah, but what happened? I was like, well, I don't know, I was just, well, shot a horse today, and, you know. She was like, well, that's pretty exciting. I was like, well, yeah, actually, that is actually quite exciting.
It is, it's mad, because any job becomes your job.
Yeah.
So as exciting as it is, you're still just doing it on a day-to-day. It's still, I always remember that from touring, that people would be, I'd get questions every day of, oh, how's the tour going?
Yeah,
be like,
it's good.
It's work, it's tour, it's lovely, they're lovely people.
I did it.
We did the gig, and now it's another one tomorrow. So yeah, it's fine, but it's wonderful to see the excitement and love that a Lady Macbeth is getting, because as you said, it was very much a low-budget independent film, so I'm sure even at the time of, or particularly at the time of making it, you don't know what this is going to become.
No.
Even though at the time of release, you don't really know what it's going to become, because the nature of independent release in the UK is you'll kind of get a small release, and if that goes well, you might get a bigger release. So for a lot of people, it's a recent film, but for you, it's was ages ago.
Totally, and I think that's part of the excitement with that film, was because none of it was... I didn't know what it was going to be.
Yeah.
I knew that this script was incredible. Yeah. I knew that this character was something that I'd never come across before, never recognised any of her in anything. That was the only thing that I was sure about. I knew Will was a lovely man. I'd seen his short film, but just as much as he'd only seen my only film, which was The Falling. There was so much uncertainty with that project, that we were all just doing the project because the script was fantastic. So as a result of that, you have incredible departments, the costume... You know, think the budget that everybody had, every department had, wasn't much. So what we got out of that film was simply because everybody wanted to lend themselves, their whole selves, into making this story, without really knowing where it was going to go. As you said, who was going to release it, who was going to distribute it. And we've got round so many of these festivals and these circuits, and now we're here, and, you know, we've been nominated for BAFTAs, and it's like... Whoa.
It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful way to do things, I think, because it means that everyone's making it purely for the art of it.
Yeah.
And there's no questions of, oh, should we do this? Is this going to work for the studio or whoever else? Yeah. It's like, no, we can just make what we all want to.
Yeah,
and that's
it's a beautiful something thing. That I love about small indies, is like you have so much, you're allowed to be a part of it.
Yeah.
Which I think, not that I'm slating big blockbuster films at all, but obviously it's a different process.
Of course.
With bigger films, there are you know, so many names and big people in suits and briefcases behind it.
That you lose so much control,
right? You do, and when you get the role's already kind of made for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're lucky to play that role, and that's great, but it is already played, it's ready.
It's there.
Whereas with a little indie, it's your baby just as much as it's, you know, the props baby.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of it.
It's a weird thing I've been realising recently, which it's a bad thing to realise considering I'm in acting now,
but
part of me wishes that all actors were only allowed to act for 5 or 6 years just because... A lot of the best things I've realised, a lot of the best things I've ever seen is when you don't know anyone in it. And this is a great example. And I was doing a podcast about The Wire recently.
Yeah.
The Wire was great because you didn't know anyone in it. Game of Thrones was great because you didn't know anyone in it. And there's a beautiful thing there. And it's a weird one. I'll briefly, I won't bore you too long, but I'll briefly tell you the story of me watching Lady Macbeth. My brother was a fan of it was originally an opera, wasn't it? It was a book and then an opera. So my brother had flagged it, and Shaheen Begg, who we'll talk about as well because of our future role in Peaky Blinders.
Yeah.
That's not really a role that's
it's
only in our heads.
No, but it is going to happen.
It's going to happen.
No, it is.
But I'd seen her tweet about it, so I was really curious, but it wasn't on in Essex where I live. So I was doing a film in Leeds, And I'd seen it was on there, and I'd thought, if I get a day off, I'll go and see it. And I'd been called into set, and I got in the car, and I was sitting in there with one of the other actors, and literally as I'm in the car, I got a text saying, oh, we don't need you today. So instead of being annoyed, I went, oh,
fantastic.
It starts in 15 minutes. So I rushed there and got in just in time and sat down, and within 10 minutes, one of the first people on the screen was the guy who I was addressing the car with, Chris Fairbanks.
No
so
way.
It took me out of it for a second. I was like,
bless.
Oh, I can't. Oh, it took me 10 minutes to lose myself in the film because I was like, oh, that's the bloke from the car. That's not the dad and this
and
that.
Fairbank. So
yeah, exactly. But he spoke so warmly of this project because it was one of the ones he'd done a few projects before what we were working on.
Yeah.
And the thing he said was the fact that so many people involved in it were brand new and were new to them, but no one was blagging it or faking it. William was just essentially said at the start, look, I've not done this before, but I believe in you guys. I need your help. And together we can all pull this together, which that sounds like a beautiful place in which to work because there's no one intimidating you and you feel, surely you feel that all of your views are as valid as anyone else in the production.
We all had captain hats on, which was wonderful. And that kind of bled into the way that we did scenes. You know, we went up 2 weeks beforehand and just had time to play, get to know one another, especially with, you know, mine. Well, with Cosmo's and Naomi's and my characters, they're all so interlinked. And it was so important for Will to give us that time. And we're so glad that he did.
And it feels like something that, again, the more experienced an actor is, the less that kind of thing will happen. Mm-hmm. It feels like if there is that air of slight, how are we doing this? We need to figure this out. Then you get that time. And both you and Cosmo were just so, you couldn't look away on the screen, and the relationship and interaction was just amazing.
You.
And that surely comes from having that time up there and learning and getting around each other.
And also that comes from brilliant casting. Like, well done, Shaheen.
Yeah.
Shaheen's been like my second agent in the industry. She got me my first film. She got me Lady Macbeth. She got me Fighting With My Family.
Yeah.
She always has quality under her wing whenever, you know, you bump into her. There's always something amazing that she's working on. And just something as simple as the right Catherine and Sebastian was so crucial.
Yeah.
And I did a whole day of like chemistry reads, and every single actor that came in was bloody amazing. But Cosmo was, we did this game where we had to push each other.
Right.
Will was so fed up of us reading like this and doing our scenes. And he was like, all right, put the scripts down. He was like, I'm going to film you and you guys are going to push each other.
Right.
We're like, what? And he was like, you're going to push each other until one of you falls over.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was like, yeah, because I love a fight. And Cosmo, we were just literally walloping each other. We were just pushing.
Amazing.
And then when he fell down, we then did the scene, like the back of the scene. And it was just so alive and so amazing. And he was willing to push me as hard as I was willing to push him. And it was just like instant energy.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. That was when I think we all kind of realised that Will was something special.
Yeah.
Because no one ever asks you to push one another.
And it's genius because it's allowing... I had Vicky McClure on recently and she was saying how in the scenes in the series of This Is England that there was rape addressed and murder and all sorts. And she was saying the key thing to all of that was Shane Meadows creating a safe place for them, and that sounds similar there. The safety to be able to just push because it's not you and Cosmo.
No,
it's the characters and it's allowing that rather than feeling you push and then have to say, "Oh, sorry, are you all right?" Finding that safety to go, no, let's ignore any politeness that you may have as a human and become the character
and
lose yourself in that.
That's what was exciting about these characters when we were doing them was. They were totally alive.
Mm.
And in the script, you know, all of those scenes where he's picking me up and chucking me and I'm pushing him, and even the sex scenes, like, they're just these really thrilling people. And it just made everything so much easier with Cozzy, knowing that if I elbowed him in the stomach, he wasn't going to, you know, blame me for it. It was just part of it. It was just part of us being Catherine and Sebastian. So, well done, Shaheen.
It takes a lot to lose yourselves in that, surely. Yeah. That's amazing. But how exciting was it to read a character like this? Because it is a period piece, but she doesn't feel like a period character. She's a strong female, but again, not even in a traditional period way, I can't even think of how to describe, but in that she's just such her own person that doesn't really care and doesn't even have to be, here I am, mm-hmm, look at me. It's mm-hmm. more like, oh, fuck off.
Yeah,
which again is, literally, that's never done in period stuff.
And but also rarely done with modern stuff.
Yeah.
Like, we've all along throughout this entire journey of when the films come up, we kept on saying she's a modern woman, but there aren't many scripts that we see of a modern to date film, like as in script, where there is that character that, as you says, just says fuck off. Like, that doesn't really happen that much. So as well, for shocking period films, it's also just like, I also love the fact that she's not nice. Yeah. I think she's delicious.
Yeah.
And I am so in love with her. But it was just so fresh and so brilliant to read a character that didn't have to be maternal, didn't have to be lovely.
Redeem herself at the end either.
She got away with it. And that has really bugged people. And that's also really, has been a great talking point to everyone, because they either love it or they hate it. And I think that's new and exciting.
Yeah, that's a key to a good project, right? Mm. It's not the desire for everyone to adore it. But just about women as well. Yeah.
You know, it's so right for now, because I think people are also realising that women... I saw this amazing, hilarious article where women were just retweeting, laughing, where it said, what do men really think about women swearing?
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and then someone said, do women really give a fuck?
Yeah.
And I think people are finally realising that women can be their own thing without men having to have an opinion about it. And that sums up Catherine completely.
Yeah.
The fact that people were so... confused that she not only did she cheat on her husband, but she had sex and she enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And then she killed someone and then she got away with it.
And didn't feel that bad about it.
And that, for me, was so exciting to have also women wanting to discuss it, but also finding the men in the Q&As that would have to tell me that they hated her.
Yeah.
And I said, great, good.
And they're like,
yes, but she's a monster. And I'm like, is she?
It's such an interesting thing, because there's obviously a lot of developments at the moment in the way Hollywood is progressing towards women because of everything mm-hmm. that's come out in the last year or two. But in all ways, and what you said there about that tweet, it sums up a lot of the confusion and annoyance about the body positivity movement that people will post a body positive image and men will comment saying, I love a natural woman. I prefer a natural woman. It's like, that's not the point of it either.
It's not about what you prefer or what you think.
It's about who an individual is. And again, bless them. They'll think they're paying a compliment and being nice. You look so much nicer without makeup.
Yeah.
Don't give a fuck.
No.
If I want to put makeup on, I'll put makeup on. But
miss the point.
It's kind of an interesting one there. And that comes into the character. And as I said, things like that tweet, are men put off by women who swear? It's like, that's nothing to do with anything.
No. Why are you writing this?
Yeah.
Why? Who told you to write this?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's swap
it around. What do women really think about men swearing?
Yeah.
What do
women think about women swearing? Yeah. Why is this a gender thing? It's like, what do people in Birmingham think about women? Why are we specifying...
What do dogs think about women swearing? Sure, I'd like to hear that one.
Daddy,
I know.
Dogs. It's an interesting one, because obviously the film is nominated for several BAFTAs and you're up for the BAFTA Rising Star,
which
is amazing and is publicly voted. So I will have pushed people at the beginning and end of the podcast to go and vote
for anyone.
That's it. It's getting that engagement.
It's a good...
But also, I can say, just vote for Florence, because it was in my films of the year. And there's always great people in
of
these
things. Of course.
Things.
But that's what's so wonderful about this that category and that nomination and that award is... This year, I think every year there's been some amazing talent that's been nominated. But this year, they've really... tried to, I think, nominate people of the same level.
Yeah.
And obviously some are higher than others, but I think the films that are behind each actor are so specific and personal and, yeah, and important and real, and actually not everyone has heard of every single one of them. And so this category has done has actually meant that any one of Tessa's fans that have seen this nomination would have gone, oh, I haven't seen Josh's film. I want to go watch it. You know, and it's all, it's just making it live again. And that's what's, I think, particularly this year, they've done really well, is it's making people that aren't really that interested.
Yeah, and people will look and see one that they like and have their vote. But then hopefully they'll go, if I liked them, then I should probably like the others. That's kind of the thing there. But because of that, you're doing a lot of press and stuff at the moment, and you had BBC Breakfast this morning.
So yeah, I was up in Manchester.
The early hours.
Saw the city.
You don't have to comment on this, but those interviews can be fucking awful because they've got such a small amount of time and they're so...
I thought it was really good.
I thought it was a nice one. But the reason it came to mind was they asked the question about of nudity
and weight.
But again, the reality is I noticed it for both the lead characters. Mm-hmm. Cosmo isn't abs
and it's real humans. The questions.
Of course. It's the woman of, you're not a waif, blah, 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 blah. So, but how was that do you decide what you take in? Because again, it's not like it's some, particularly at the time, it's a huge film.
Totally.
But to me, none of the nudity jumped out.
Well,
it felt completely natural and normal.
Don't even notice
exactly it. Yeah.
They watch it and they go, okay, people have had sex and that looks pretty, you know, all right, cool. And then they get out of bed and guess what? They live their lives.
Yeah. It's not gratuitous.
I think for me that's a massive nudity thing. In my first film, I did two sex scenes in my first ever film, and Carol Morley was the director, and she just kind of mothered me, and everything was so safe.
Yeah.
And my family is super supportive, and my mum wouldn't have let me do any film that, you know, let me do a sex, like, they're not like that. But what I am saying is it's very rare that a film like that was good and the right people watched it and it was the right type of sex scene. And the things that I am willing to take my clothes off for and burn my skin, it is for things that aren't gratuitous, things that betray real life. And that was something so important with Lady Macbeth, was everything about Catherine is about how she feels and how she's going to act instinctively on a moment. And is she the type of person that would really get out of bed wearing knickers? No. So as long as I know that, and as long as we both trust each other, then it really doesn't matter who else thinks what. And I think I stand by that. And what's been so interesting about Lady Macbeth is so many times people have tried to make it a thing that I'm naked. And actually, if you ask any person that's watched the film, it's really not a big thing.
No.
I think the only scene that is a big thing is in the first scene. I'm asked to take my clothes off by the man that I just marry. And he then gets into bed and turns the light off. So
again, that's anybody, a key and powerful scene. It wouldn't work without me.
But anybody that sees the film, it's not even a thing. And I think the media constantly keep on trying to make it a thing that I'm naked or that I'm okay within my skin. And whilst that's true, I really don't mind talking about it. It's the same thing that we were talking about earlier. It doesn't have to be a conversation.
Yeah.
And because it is a conversation, people keep on saying, you know, are you okay with it? People keep on wanting to talk about the fact that you're naked. It then becomes a thing again. And as we were discussing, you know, Cosmo is just as naked in that film as I am.
Yeah.
And we both felt the same thing. There were days where we would just be literally in and out of our dressing gowns because we'd be doing beds and whatever. It really wasn't a thing by the end of it. But obviously people want to talk to me about it because I'm the woman and because... Yeah.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, it's the one thing I added to my notes after the... Because that wasn't in my notes because it isn't something that I remembered particularly as a standout thing.
What?
But
I love talking about it.
It jumped out at me because I was like, well, Cosmo was exactly the same.
Exactly.
Again, it wasn't like it was... He looked like this film star and was or even the shooting of it. It wasn't like
totally.
He was shot so it's beautiful.
No.
And everyone was shot in a very... natural way. I think the thing that gets me, and I think we're going in this direction because of the avenues available to independent film and the avenues available to TV, is that censorship of language and nudity, the reason we shouldn't have them there isn't for them to be exploited or have swearing in every scene, but have it swearing in any scene you want or need, and nudity in any scene you want or need, rather than thinking, can we have a boob here or can we have a willy here?
It's
would that character be naked?
Totally.
Yes.
And I've always found it hilarious. I would much rather see a breast or a bum or a willy on screen than someone getting shot in the head.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it's backwards.
Yeah.
For some reason, people are more terrified of their 8-year-old child accidentally seeing a nipple than they are of someone being in some sort of massacre, which is bizarre because that's how it's rated.
It's really worrying, isn't it? That's it's genuinely bizarre. Worrying is that humans rated. Are being brought up in
totally.
That way.
Totally. You know, kids are allowed to see so much violence and death, and but one boob or one bum cheek, and that's terrifying. Yeah. Why is it terrifying? It means that things like conversations about me getting naked are so big of a deal. It's not
it's
a big
crazy,
deal.
Isn't it?
And a again, body shouldn't be terrifying.
No, I understand the fear of or not wanting a child to see a sex scene.
Totally.
Or this, that's sexualized, but just the human body. It
that
disturbs
shouldn't
me
be
hugely
terrifying.
That that's this.
I know.
Scary,
and so that's what's
thing.
Why I've been so interested. I've grown up, my parents have always tried to get us to, you know, grow up with great films and European films and old films, and always me and my everyone would just roll their eyes when we'd see a sex scene where the woman is wearing a bra or, you know, just bizarre things. And that's how I've been brought up. And I've always known that, you know, obviously, my body is for me, and what I decide to, you know, show it to is completely down to me. But I don't mind people seeing bodies. Bodies really shouldn't be the thing that we're terrified
of.
And yet what's been so interesting about the press of this film is people are always scared. Do you mind talking about it? That's what they say. Do you mind about talking about me and my body? And that's the thing that makes it funny. Because A, it doesn't have to be a scary conversation.
Yeah.
And B, we can talk about it. Bodies.
And equally, again, it's that fear of any discussion. Equally, that they can ask and you can say no and they can move on.
Yeah, sure.
That shouldn't be some big thing. It's like, no, I'm not actually comfortable talking about that. All right, cool.
No,
how about this rather than this
exactly.
fear? So was acting always your desire, like, growing up?
Yeah,
were you,
I'd say
because
so.
You've got into it quite young. Really,
yeah.
Because I guess you shot Lady Macbeth,
although I'm
what,
quite
at
old
19
now.
Or 20?
I turned 22 in January.
Look at you, you're getting
I mean,
on.
It is January, on January the 3rd.
Right, wow.
Better get my life together.
Yeah, yeah. But so was that always, was what films and actors and actresses were inspiring you when you were younger and drawing you to the screen?
Yeah, I'd always wanted to do it. I was always loud. I was a family of four kids, mm-hmm. and we all love singing and being on stage and being funny and just basically the worst person that you want to get drunk at a party. That was always what I wanted to do. And I wasn't good at the other side. I wasn't good at the academic stuff. I was always more inclined to being arty and making pots and singing with my guitar. So that was always where I wanted to go. I didn't know how I was going to get into the industry. I had no idea. But there was nothing else. I had no... I completely... fucked up my GCSEs,
right.
And I didn't do too well on my A levels either. So it was like there was only one. I only wanted to do that. And then when it got to the time of me deciding whether I was going to go to drama school, I did this funny little audition that I didn't expect anyone would ever see the tape for, The Falling, and I ended up getting it.
Oh wow!
So much of like what has happened has been complete right time, right place.
Yeah.
And also, whilst I support that, it's obviously about what you do when you have that moment.
Completely.
So, you know, I've done my dues of doing dodgy auditions, and obviously there have been other actors that have done it for years beforehand. But, like, you know, however you get into the industry, it's when you get there, it's so hard to get it going anyway. So I always find it funny when people try and label whatever... corner you've come from as, oh, well, you didn't try that hard. And it's like, it's such a stupid conversation to have, because any industry is the same. You work bloody hard to get there. And then if you get there and, you know, it rides out well, then congratulations.
Completely.
So I find it all very funny about conversations about do you agree with, you know, how people get into the industry. And it just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
If you could do it, great, well done. And no matter how you got there, brilliant. So yeah, my mine started off really, really lucky. And
Because that's it. Again, a lot of people will, number one, try and argue that there isn't any luck involved. There 100% is luck involved in every industry. But you can prepare for that luck to come.
Yeah.
So you were preparing and getting good, and then a lucky break happened. But again, luck's only ever an opportunity anyway.
Yeah.
You don't luck your way into a lead role.
No.
You luck your way into an interview or an audition, maybe.
Totally.
But you don't get it from luck. You get it from all the work you've put in to be the right person in that time.
And it's exactly how much work you put in when you get there. You know, it's all very well getting a role and doing a film, but do you want it to continue afterwards?
Yeah.
And are you willing to put in the hours to make sure that it can? So that was always, that was a funny, from The Falling until Lady Macbeth, that was a funny period because it was 2 years of just lots of people. When I did The Falling, I would go into meetings and they would, because the film wasn't out and it wasn't available, I would sit down in these meetings really eager and be like, oh, yeah, I'm Florence. And I just did this film called The Falling with Maisie. And they'd be like, cool. And I'd be like, yeah, well, I just did this meeting with Maisie and not so this film. And they'd be like, yeah, well, the thing is, though, Florence, is sometimes it's a one-strike wonder.
Yeah.
I'd be like, what? I'd be like, you know, sometimes it doesn't actually go too well after that. You know, you could just be brilliant in The Falling and then that's it. And so I went through this very funny stage of having to kind of, like, prove myself.
Yeah.
And then the right script, like Lady Macbeth, popped up. And I did that, but that was 2 years after I filmed The Falling. So it's interesting. You know, people always are like asking me now, oh, I bet scripts are being chucked on your desk. It's like, yeah, but actually, God, it did take, you know, its own journey to get there.
Completely. And it's not as simple as that. There is that illusion outside. I remember when I had Doc Brown on, he was saying after he did the Gervais movie and it was huge and all that, he'd walk around his local area and people would be like, oh, why are you still here? You're famous. It's like, you know, that was like 3 months of filming.
Yeah.
That's it. That's one gig. That doesn't then mean I'm now rich suddenly, or got a million jobs or whatever else. It's that kind of, that reality of everyone's chasing that big break and then you get it and you realise, all right, I still need to keep working.
I need to wait a year until it's edited and comes out.
Completely. I know that the first acting role I got was in Guy Ritchie's King Arthur and I ended up getting
Completely cut out of it. Yeah.
But I was hugely excited in all the meetings. My thought was, I know my role in it's small, so I need to get as many meetings before it comes out.
Oh, totally.
So they don't know how small my role is. So I can be, I've started off in a Guy Ritchie film, this. And then, because I knew that when it actually came out, I only had a small part,
and then no part.
But that was my thinking, was exactly that of, well, while they're editing it,
I'll trade off this. Yeah, exactly. I'll keep it going.
So how great has it been getting in with someone like Shaheen, because she is a wonderful casting director and she loves who she loves.
Totally.
So if the roles come up, she's someone that will really push you and
but what I love about her is she won't just make her, you know, her gang do a film because she's got it. It will be completely right for you if she's comfy 100%. For it.
I had a meeting with her about 2 years ago now, and we've not worked together yet, but we talk all the time because, again, it's that exact thing. It's like, right, when the right fit comes, it'll be right for the reason. And again, I think that's a key thing, because if you did have someone in the industry who's getting you gigs that you're not ready for or not right for, then the likelihood they're going to go badly.
Yeah.
If they're only pushing you for the ones that you can excel in,
totally,
then everything you do is going to
exactly. It's
going to be like that.
No, I was part of my huge luck was meeting Shaheen on my first film. And they wanted to find an unknown, but they also needed to make sure that the unknown was all right, I suppose. Yeah. And so after about 5 callbacks, Shaheen and Carol, they gave me the offer. And then since then, she's just been my hero. And I can't actually thank her enough. She has got me the main bulk of my work. So, meeting people like Shaheen is so important, people that are going to fight for you until the end.
Yeah.
And then also having people like that on your own team is so important.
Yeah,
I have a really fantastic team now where we're all aware of what we're all looking for, and it doesn't matter what's put in front of me, who's, you know, the director, how much they're paying, that has nothing. It's if this woman that I'm going to be playing is going to be something, if she's going to be something interesting,
yeah,
exciting, thrilling, she doesn't have to be nice.
Yeah.
And I think that's a massive part of it. Who's playing on your team?
Yeah.
And I'm safe.
It's a beautiful thing. And again, I keep likening it to the music industry, but it's my frame of reference. But
yeah, yeah.
I think when I did my first album, we didn't know anyone would hear it, so yeah, we just made it our way. But that meant that when it was successful, we could just keep making it our way. And that's a similar thing. You've done films that you don't know if they're going to be anything,
and they've
been praised and successful. Therefore, you don't have to go, oh, we need to change our plan. Yeah. You can continue to go, right, let's pick the right things. It's not if the first thing you've done was some huge blockbuster and you had a small role, then you might think, oh, it's a step down now, or this or that. You can continue to go, let's find that character, and it will rise above everything else on its own.
Yeah, and like someone asked me in a Q&A the other day, would you ever play a character like Catherine again? It's like, well, no, I've done it. Not that I've done it and been there, done that, but like, I don't know how I would change that, and I don't know how, and I don't know if I would want to. I think, you know, you do a certain part in that specific time in your life where you tackle it, and you hope that it's okay. And then when you've done that, you never really revisit it again, which is why I think when you see these series going on for so long, how amazing that actors can come back to it and be that character again and again and again and again. And what a job that is.
Yeah.
And to keep it alive and to keep it exciting. And for me, I'm like, you know, I've done it. And then I'm on to the next one, as we said. What's new?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, one of the ones down the line is us in Peaky Blinders as brother and sister.
Shaheen,
now, to explain to people, we've been hassling Shaheen on Twitter about this, that...
Shaheen, we will pay for your coffees, by the way, and we will definitely, like, buy you donuts and pastries. So I don't know why you're taking so
just
long about
have a word.
It.
I mean,
just,
if anyone else who's listening knows Stephen Knight, because again, my thought now,
we'll write the script.
That's it. We're niece and nephew of Alfie Solomon, and we're seeking revenge. Because again,
love it. Keep
spoilers,
the beard,
but you know, we've got to go after, and you know, we're in there and chasing revenge. And we've got
I
that
think
anger.
That would work. And we can do, you know, maybe we don't even have to have the same accents.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We can be from anywhere. He moved about.
Some geezer. And she too.
Yeah.
Look, you don't have to worry about the scripts, guys. We'll definitely get on that. Just pop us in. He has the kit, the mic kit. So we're sorted.
I've got mics. I can set us up. I've got, you know, we've got it covered, essentially. So
the point is, just let us know when the shoot starts and we'll be there.
It's perfect. It's lined up. So how was it taking on a character that's not only still alive...
Are we still talking about Peaky?
No, we're moving on from Peaky now. We're going on...
I was going to say, this is getting really serious.
How is it in Peaky Blinders? How is it being in the last season?
What's the script like, Florence?
So a film that's coming out this year is Fighting With My Family, mm-hmm. which is based on Ryan Knight, who is Paige in WWE, who I've known her and her mum online and through tweets and that and
amazing.
Through texts for years, and it's an amazing story. So, but it must be an unusual one to take on, because generally when a biopic is being made, it's when someone's either dead or older, but Paige is still young
She's still fantastic.
And in the WWE.
Yeah.
How was that to take on... such a character.
Well, yet again, lovely Shaheen sent over this audition, and I just remember from first reading just one of the scenes. I can't obviously actually describe any of the scenes because none of you have seen them. But I was already so excited by the way that this scene was written. I didn't have the script. I just had one scene, and it was between Rhea and her brother.
Yeah.
And I was just, it just felt real, and it felt completely honest. And then obviously when I read up on what this was for and who this woman was, I got so excited but also really scared, because I started imagining myself playing her.
Yeah.
And I sometimes do. I always know what it is that I really want to do next, because there'll be scripts where I'll read it and I'll be like, oh, that's amazing, that's amazing, that's amazing. And I imagine myself doing it and I'm like, yeah. And then there's some scripts where I'm reading, I'm like, wow, incredible. And I imagine myself doing it and I'm so scared.
That's amazing.
I'm so scared, and it's not even that I'm terrified to touch the material. I'm terrified, and that somewhere in me means that I've got to do it.
Mm.
And it's this funny game that I play with myself.
It's amazing because I've literally had that in the last week for the first time. I had a script through, and again, I won't go into any of this, but it was an audition for a character that I was already hugely familiar with and a big fan of. And I got the email. I was like, yes.
Yeah.
And then when I had to go to do the tape, I was like, shit.
Scared.
This is terrifying.
And then once
I actually started to do it, I loved it. It's my favourite audition I've done, and it was amazing. But there was that absolute fear. I was like, this is a role I would have killed for until I was asked to audition. And then I'm like, I don't want anything to do with it. No. Please, don't put it on me. I don't want the pressure. Don't. That's scary.
I just wanted to do the audition.
Yeah.
I was just free one Thursday.
Exactly.
I was just bored of Pret.
But how is that then, to push yourself through that?
A couple of things this year that I've done have utterly terrified, all of them have utterly terrified me. Fighting with my family, I was terrified because this woman was, as you said, still alive now.
Yeah.
And she was just incredible. She was so badass. She was everything that we've been discussing about women. Like, she was different.
Such an amazing story none of that is off. But because it was originally a documentary of Fight With My Family, wasn't it? And the fact that her whole family were wrestlers. Her mum, I had Lena Headey on the other week, in fact, who plays your mum in it.
Yes.
And, you know, the whole family of wrestlers and Rhea or Paige from, I think, about 14 or 15 left home to go off and wrestle all around Europe and all this. And I believe that's kind of the story that's told, was the youth and then to the getting into the WWE and all that. And amazing.
So a young
woman just going, it's not about like male or female. She's like, I was born a wrestler. That's my family.
Yeah.
Rather than I was born female or whatever, I was born a wrestler. And just this powerful woman.
That's what was so exciting about it, though, was like, I knew nothing about WWE.
Yeah.
I think the last memory I have of me personally taking part in something WWE was when my brother was about 10 and I was 6 and he was reenacting some Rock thingy-ma-bob. and so that was probably the last. I didn't really know what it was. Obviously, I see it. I didn't really...
That's a good thing, though, because, again, the perception casually will be nothing like the reality of what you've then had to learn and do, surely.
And then I read it and I'm terrified. I'm terrified because I can't imagine myself doing this. I can't imagine myself... I can imagine myself wrestling. I've always loved, like, fighting and fighting and being strong. But I just couldn't see...
Is that why you were asked in... Or was it the pushing of Cosmo in that initial audition? They're like, we'll get her back. She doesn't mind
smacking
someone.
She doesn't mind getting bruised. Oh, God, that sounds awful. and I just, it was just exciting, really exciting. And Paige is everything about a woman that I just love. And I think that's why she did so well in WWE, was because there was this massive chunk of WWE fans that didn't feel like they belonged to a specific character.
Yeah.
And Paige came in and she was young and feisty. She didn't give a toss. She was pale. She had piercings. She had messy black hair.
Yeah.
And she just didn't give a fuck.
And that wasn't the perception of women in wrestling.
No, not at all.
Point.
Women in wrestling at that point had been, you know, bronzed skin, very perfect, very poised, you know, beautiful and toned and blonde, which is wonderful. But Paige wasn't that at all. And that's what really made people go, oh, yeah, she's the sore thumb that sticks out and I love her. So we filmed the part that we were telling was she and her brother had been wrestling since they were tiny. And her brother is about a year older than her, or 2 years older than her. And had been wanting to had started wrestling a little bit before her, but they all then caught up and they all wrestled. And they both then got to an age where they auditioned for WWE, I think, when they were about 17, 18. I think that was about the time. And unfortunately, she got in and he didn't, which, as close as that family was, as you can imagine, heartbreaking.
Yeah, of course.
And she then moved over to Florida and started her wrestling career, and her brother stayed home with their family and just got on.
Mm.
And I think that's what's so wonderful about this, our version of the story, is it's not necessarily just showing her glory and her side of it and her succeeding. It's also saying that, you know, sometimes life isn't like a movie.
Yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't go to plan.
And again, it's hard. It's hard emotionally because they're going to be supportive, but equally, her mum and dad had been wrestling their whole lives and not made it to that.
Yeah,
to that level. So there's going to be a level of that, of like, I'm so proud and happy, but that's what I always wanted.
Yeah.
And you always, you should always want that for your kids. But I can also completely understand that there'll be a little of, fuck, I didn't get that.
Yeah. How come that didn't happen? So that obviously, as any family, I mean, families, they suffer anyway, but I can imagine that's obviously a very difficult thing to kind of deal with. So we have told that part of the story, and I really wanted to make it, and so did Stephen Merchant directed
it. He wrote and directed
which
is fantastic.
He really wanted, and I really wanted, us to all do the wrestling.
Yeah.
And that's what I loved about it, was like, you know, when do film productions ever allow you to be body slammed?
Yeah.
That, I mean, you're never usually allowed to do your own stunts unless you're, what's his name? Come on, Tom. Is it Tom?
Who? Hardy?
No. Who does their own stunts?
Who does it? Tom Cruise.
Yes, there we go.
Of course he does. Yeah. And he just injured himself. Yeah. So no one will be allowed again.
Films never allow it because guess what? They end up having to pay a lot if you get hurt.
Yeah.
But they actually were really into us doing our own wrestling. And that was a massive yes for me. That's why I kind of wanted to do it.
How did you find that? Like the training and all that? Because it's massively... It's a psychological thing, a lot of it, is the comfort in throwing yourself or trusting someone else to throw you and so on and so forth. It's a two-way street.
Totally. And I think, you know, we trained really hard. Jack Loudon plays Zach Knight, my brother in it. Mm-hmm. Well, her brother, sorry. And we got on it, on CrossFit really, really, well, as quickly as we got cast, because we needed to not even necessarily look good, but we just needed to be able to pick up a person.
Yeah.
That's what wrestling is about. It's not about, you know, can I pick up her, but can she pick up me and then me pick up her? You know, that's what it's about. It's throwing bodies around. So
completely. There's moves that you can't do on someone if they're not athletic enough.
No.
So it's not just about what you can do. It's what the two of you can do together. It's being able to...
Yeah.
To go both ways.
Yeah, so we trained with CrossFit really, really hard. And then we obviously started wrestling. And obviously we all had fantastic wrestling body doubles to do the moves that would make us die.
Yeah, yeah.
But we tried to do as much of it as possible. And it was so much fun. But, you know, what was exciting to learn about that sport, which was obviously the moves, and you really have to do it. It's also heartbreaking because that's what makes a lot of the wrestlers have their career come to an end.
Yeah, completely.
It's not a feasible sport, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reason why people get so funny about explaining whether it's real or fake or whatever is because, it's a dance.
Yeah.
It is a dance. It's choreography. But where it's fake, you have to overcompensate in other areas.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you thump me now, you're not actually going to thump me in the face and I'm going to have to spin my head. Or if you're, you know, up for that, you can thump me in the face. But where I then make it look real is when you pick me up and throw me on the floor and I am going to throw myself so far back and onto the mat as hard as possible to make it all seem Punch and Judy. Yeah. So that's where it hurts, because you then get people completely pumped on adrenaline, throwing themselves on their necks, on their backs, on their everything. And of course, they've then buggered their ligaments by the age of 30.
And it's the really weird thing, because there's the perception, or even just the term, that it's fake, which, again, it's planned out. It's this and that. People will watch and go, I don't know how they do that without hurting each other. It's like,
no, they don't.
They do hurt each other. They don't do it without hurting. It's like, oh, how did they fake him?
Yeah.
Falling off there onto the floor. It's like, no, he fell onto the floor. Like, again, as you said, a punch can be cheated and faked, but you can't fake throwing someone out of a ring.
No.
You could learn to fall,
but
that doesn't mean you could learn to fall and not get hurt in any way. It's going to be impact. It's going to be the shaking of the bones.
Yeah,
and
totally. And it does, else. It really does hurt. And I think we knew that, but when we started filming, we just got on with it, you know, a bruise, whatever is a bruise. But looking back at it, of course you're going to have funny knees if you're dropping mine and your weight on my knees. And so, you know,
4, 5, 6 times a week as well. Again, the schedule of touring wrestlers, that it's constant. It's one thing for a few bumps in a film. and it's a few days here and there.
It's a tough life, and I really take my hat off to anyone that's in the ring.
Yeah.
And, you know, we actually did a scene. The moment in Paige's life that really changed everything was when she went out to Raw and she won from AJ Lee. She won the belt.
At 19. On her debut. I know. Again, huge. Because, I mean, I was going to mention that because what you touched upon there was the fact that she was unusual and different. But she was unusual and different.
And unknown.
But she had tons of experience and was pushed straight to the top. It's not like she was presented as, here's all the girls and then here's the alternative token representation of the alternative. It's like, no, she's coming in and being pushed right to the top, which was an amazing thing.
Yeah, and so we did that scene. So Paige, just debriefing if you don't know, she was training.
It's confusing because Paige is Rhea.
I know.
Her real name is Rhea.
Her real name is Rhea Knight.
Her mum's wrestling name is Soraya, though.
Let's
so
not
it's very
get
confusing.
Bogged down. So Paige is her wrestling name, and you know this. I'm explaining to the listeners.
Yeah, completely. It's
she,
so confusing.
She, when she got signed by WWE, that didn't necessarily mean that she went to go and wrestle with all the big wrestling stars. She went to NXT and she trained. And NXT is this kind of like schooling for wrestlers where you can be fantastic and you can be you could have been wrestling for the past 8 years, but until the big names in suits tell you that you're ready, you will train in the NXT for as long as they need you to. In the NXT, you'll wake up at 8 and you'll do wrestling training from 8 until, you know, 2, and then you'll do workouts from 2 until 8. That's the life. So it's really, really hard, really grueling. Anyway, so Paige had been in the NXT and she basically got pushed to the top, as you said, and then one night, Dwayne contacted her and basically told her that she was going to be asked the following day to go out on Monday Night Raw and win the belt off AJ Lee, who had been the longest reigning diva, I think, in Diva's wrestling term. History. Yeah.
And that's Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
And Dwayne
right?
The Rock
that's
Johnson the, actually said that. So Paige, who had been in the NXT for a bit, but not as long as other people had, then suddenly had to go out in front of 20,000 people and basically persuade an audience to like her.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, imagine that's what wrestling is about, whether an audience likes or dislikes you, whether you're a babyface or a heel.
Yeah.
So she came out, people kind of knowing who she was because she was NXT, but not really. And then she won the fight.
Yeah.
Now, obviously,
it's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
That moment just, it's insanity, isn't it? For someone who's new as well.
The nerves. And so we filmed that. We went over to LA and we filmed in the Staples Center at the end of a Monday Night Raw.
Wow.
And they had just done a Monday Night Raw. And we needed the crowd.
Yeah.
We needed some of the crowd and we needed the space in the arena so it all looked real. And basically, Dwayne went out after the evening when everyone was just about to go. Dwayne went out and said, "Hi, everyone," basically.
Yeah.
And everyone popped.
Of course.
It was just screaming for about 8 minutes, I'd say.
Yeah.
And he tried to get a word in edgeways and he couldn't. He had to keep on stopping and everyone was just yelling. So then he asked if anybody would mind staying to watch this match. Everybody stayed. Amazing. So now I'm actually going out and doing a wrestling match in front of all those people that have been there on Monday Night Raw.
Now. Yeah.
And they play Paige's music. Now, obviously, Paige had been off wrestling. Last year, she was off wrestling for a year. And she is obviously, like, people love her. She's their body, their woman. And so the music plays and everybody pops because it's Paige. And they know that it's me and they know that it's an actor.
Yeah,
and Dwayne has said, look, be kind.
I was going to say, I'm glad he's explained this because that is pressure.
And so I come out and everybody's so warm and lovely and ready to love me because I'm playing Paige. And then also people are not ready to love me because why isn't Paige doing it? Which I always find hilarious. Yeah, why isn't Paige doing it?
Yeah.
And we did that fight in front of so many people and it was just like, whoa, that was a moment. And that was a moment where, you know, I wrestled in the Staples Center, age 21, and I'm not a wrestler, and I will never be able to say that again.
Yeah.
And that was mental. I saw what these wrestlers go through. And there's, you know, it's true that everybody said, you know, you'll never get a feeling like wrestling in that crowd. And I understood the fun of wrestling, and I got it, and now it was fun, and you get to play fight. But I never quite understood why people kept on doing it. Like, until that point, I didn't get it. And everyone kept on saying, just wait, just wait, just wait. And when I was out there, everyone was roar, like screaming, chanting, making up their own chants. Every time you do anything, they roar. And then you get a couple of, you know, Muppets in the front that decide to shout abuse at you.
Yeah.
But that's wrestling. The audience don't necessarily love you, and they don't necessarily, like, hate you.
Yeah.
They're just, that's part of the performance. They're allowed to kind of do both.
Yeah, cool.
And that's what was so exhilarating and exciting about it. And there was so much adrenaline that you feel like a superhero. And this is obviously where that point in wrestling where it's beneficial and not, where there's so much superhero adrenaline going through you that you can do anything, and you can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's obviously where it starts going wrong, because
it starts to hurt,
you become a superhero for 8 minutes. You're allowed to be a superhero, and everyone thinks you're amazing, and you think everyone's amazing, and you think you're amazing. And then at the end of the fight, you're like, wow, I'm hurting.
I am in a lot of pain.
And but there's nothing, I've never felt that before. Mm. So, yeah, having been a complete, I mean, I knew nothing about WWE, I knew nothing about wrestling, and I did it for a short amount of time, but I did all of it.
Yeah.
I can say that it is not, for the just that career is not easy, and
it's
incredibly
tough. Yeah.
It is hard, and what Paige has accomplished at such a young age, Jesus Christ, that is hard.
Yeah, yeah. I love hearing stories about that, because seeing how the inner workings of the film industry works, the fact that it is essentially The Rock going out and going, would you mind all sticking about, please?
Oi, guys.
Like, kind of getting about you think anything on screen, it's like, God, they've all paid 20,000 extras. They've done this and that. It's like, it's The Rock going, have you got 10 minutes? We're just going to quickly, if you can just stick around, that would be great.
Also, can you actually give us some more of the energy that you've been using during that actual fight? If you can actually be screaming for this pretend page, that'd be great.
And it's amazing how last minute a lot of that could be. I did a wrestle, or the film I was doing with Chris Fairbank is a wrestling film.
Mm.
And it was a similar thing where they were going to be doing this one scene at these this World of Sport event that was happening, and that event got pulled.
Oh, God.
So then they're like, right, we've now got to kind of figure it out. And but I love seeing stuff like that, because you, again, you just assume, you look on the screen, you think all of this, they've just thrown money at it, they've done this. It's not. There's so much there that's just the hard work of the people behind the scenes, favours being grabbed,
so
and
many,
all sorts of little ins so and outs, many, that it's not this huge, shining, polished thing.
Yeah, I think...
I love that.
I think the industry is completely made up of favours. That's what it is. As you said, Dwayne going out and asking the public, can you stay a bit?
Guys.
we would. No one would be able to afford paying 20,000 people for the day.
No.
It would all be either CGI or... But, of course, the thing is, you with something like that, you couldn't just have a CGI. I needed to have that response, just like they needed to have me wrestling.
Yeah.
There's it goes hand in hand.
Completely.
In order for that to feel and be what wrestling is like, you needed the people there.
Yeah, it's like they always
don't say that.
In wrestling, you can't, if you've been out injured or whatever, you can't get ring fit until you're in there. Because it is that adrenaline will give you energy or sap your energy. There's so many things that can go on that you could have been training for weeks and weeks, but then you get in there and you're knackered after five minutes because of, you can't replicate that. It's a unique thing, the reaction to your body, the reaction of everything.
Yeah.
How was working with Stephen? Because I think he's fantastic.
And
I love that he's finally kind of getting to step away from the office and everything else that he's done wonderfully. I thought in Logan he was fantastic and I love
beautiful role.
His stand-up's fantastic. I think he's a real, obviously he's huge, but it feels to me like the best is yet to come with him, because
like he's
so intelligent and so clever.
Himself. Side to himself, sorry. I mean, Stephen is so, he's such a specific director that I've ever, like, he's so particular.
Right.
And he knows. He knows everything.
Yeah.
He has an idea, and he's so clever, and he's a bit of a genius. There you go, Stephen, if you're listening. but what's so wonderful about all of that, you know, he's very funny and humorous, and his writing is that too. but also not afraid to look at the dark side of it. Mm-hmm. You know, this storyline, obviously it's going to be funny. It's got Nick Frost, Vince Vaughn, Dwayne Johnson, and Stephen Rota, and he's in it.
Yeah.
But it's also, he's also not scared of showing the crap bit to life. And that's what all of us, we actually all live through. And that's what's so beautiful about our story is it's real. Yeah. Yes, Paige goes off and becomes this superstar, but also everybody else just has to get on with life.
Yeah.
And that's the heartbreaking thing, is that's what we all do sometimes, most of the time. I'm so very lucky to play this role and to be able to fight as well. I keep on saying this, but it's such an important thing for me to be able to do everything and be that role. And Stephen was a massive, he wanted me to do it too. He wanted me to get, you know, strong and to fight, and that was great. That was wicked. And also he made me be funny, so that's great.
it's I think what's great about Stephen and Ricky and even Nick and Simon Pegg at that time is they were all comfortable in writing the funny, but then happy to show the dark, and also not be scared of showing the beauty as well, which I think it's easy in comedy to be drawn towards the cynical laughs, because that's kind of, you're all in on the joke.
Yeah.
And it's scary to have the warm moments. Yeah. But The Office is a prime example of that. And stories are like this. It's going to have huge dark moments. It's going to have these beautiful, glowing, warm moments, I'm sure. And I love that. I love writers and directors who are comfortable with all of it, rather than thinking, are people going to think this is cheesy? Are people going to think it's like, well, no, if life is cheesy sometimes.
And if that's, it's done right, then, you know.
So, So what else is ahead? You've got The Commuter coming out this year. It's weird because you've done so much.
I know. Well,
last year or since Lady Macbeth, but now that's at the forefront of everyone's mind. There's a lot.
So last year I was very busy and I was very happy being busy, but it kicks off with Fighting With My Family. And then Lady Macbeth came out, and then after summer I went and did this film called King Lear, which. Yeah. I'm still, I can't believe that I got a part in. I played Cordelia, and Richard Eyre directed, and Anthony Hopkins was King Lear.
Good Lord.
Emma Thompson was Goneril, and Emily Watson, oh my God, I can't remember the other name. My brain is so fuzzy, I'm so sorry, was another sister. And
you should stick with this acting. It seems like it's going well. It seems
Jim Broadbent, amazing. Jim Carter, just these incredible people that I have watched on my screen since I was tiny. And I was terrified. I got that role, and it came through, and I couldn't quite believe that it was real, because it's every, you know, acting dream. And then I had about 2 months until the rehearsal started. I was absolutely shitting myself, like totally shitting, like not only shitting myself for me, but because it was going to be with these people, that this was no joke. This was no, you know, they've done this. They've done Shakespeare. Yeah. Richard Eyre has, you know, directed all of the greats.
Yeah.
So doing that was a massive deal for me, and I was so scared. And on the first day, I remember just telling everyone how scared I was, and so many people were like, oh, you'll be fine, just be yourself. And my mum was like, don't. She was like, be quiet, don't talk, make sure you listen, you're a sponge, absorb. And I was like, yes, that is very good advice. So I went, and for the first like 3 hours, I was still, and I was absorbing, and I was listening. And then I couldn't do that anymore because I just wanted to talk to everyone.
Yeah.
So I learned so much from that. And I met every single one of my heroes, and they were all just delightful human beings.
Yeah.
So that was wicked. I did that one. And then I did Outlaw King.
Yep.
Which is about Robert, the Bruce.
Yeah.
And I play his wife, and Chris Pine plays Robert, and David McKenzie was the director. And I was basically in Scotland for about 3 months, hanging out with about 20 big burly bearded Scots.
Amazing.
And I was in love with all of them, and they were all in love with me. And we were just like this really wonderful best friend family unit. So that was just so much fun. And acting alongside Chris was amazing. And he plays a really, really good Scottish king, and his accent is wicked. So he does a fantastic job, and everybody's been asking me, what was the accent like? I was like, it was fine. Why wouldn't it be fine? So that was amazing. And then what have I got now? Oh, I'm working on Little Drummer Girl.
Yes.
which is a BBC series. And if anybody watched The Night Manager last year, it's the same people are making another one of John Le Carre's.
Such an amazing series, wasn't it? Just everyone involved in that.
Elizabeth Debicki, oh my God, massive girl crush. I'm in love with her. Yeah. I fancy her so much.
Yeah, she's amazing. She is everyone amazing. In it, though, from top to bottom, was
totally
on absolute point.
They're making another series. Completely new story, new book. It's The Little Drummer Girl, and it's a six-parter. And we're starting that now, AMC as well.
Yeah.
So that's going to be wicked, and they're all coming out at the same time.
I was going to say, because that's interesting, because film takes so much longer to come out than TV most of the time.
I don't know why that is.
It's bizarre, isn't it?
Like, they're hoping to air it in autumn.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Sorry if I get that wrong.
It's autumn,
and someone's listening and it's not out. But who's staying up that late and editing? I don't understand.
Yeah.
For a film, it takes forever.
Yeah.
We're getting going on that now, which is why I have a luminous hair right now.
Yes, indeed. It's glowing.
It's glowing. I'm like Gandalf's wand.
Is the plan to kind of just keep pushing forward and firing on all cylinders? Because at the moment it feels like each gig is leading on to another gig, and there's no time to sit back and worry about any of it as such.
I've had a really... From this time last year, I went to Sundance with Lady Macbeth, and I went straight from Sundance to training in the NXT with Jack.
Wow.
And it hasn't stopped really since. Obviously, well, actually, since Lady Macbeth came out in the festivals that summer. But really, work-wise, it's been a really wonderful previous year.
Yeah.
And I haven't really been thinking about when things are coming out. It's just been like, that's filming in August.
It?
Okay, great.
I'll remember that.
Yeah. that's work that's going to happen in November. Great, I'll do, you know. And I think you never really know until about a couple of months beforehand anyway. It's not like I knew this time last year that I had Fight for My Family, King Lear out. You know, it all just happens accidentally. And you'll never be able to prepare, and you'll never be able to plan. And the moment you say that you'll do that, you probably won't, because you're doing, you know, that's the kind of annoying but wonderful thing about this job, is it's you find out last minute, mostly always. So I'm slightly weirdly no not weirdly I'm scared. I've now done all my jobs, and I'm doing The Little Drummer Girl, and there's going to be some silence until they come out.
Until they start filming the last series of Peaky Blinders.
Yeah, and then when we have to start writing with that. So I'm going to have a bit of time and just do some reading. I'm really interested in finding the next thing, and I think I want to do some. I want to do something small again.
I was going to say, is there anything that you're drawn towards, theme-wise or era-wise or star-wise, that you've not done that you're kind of thinking, oh, I'd love to do something along them lines?
Yeah, I think I'm not meaning to start conversations or spark, you know, hunches, but just in the last year, I've really realised that I want to do some more female-orientated work. That's not because of the movement or anything, you know, even though it is and should be.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't to do with that. It's simply that I feel like I've done lots of storylines now, and I've done lots of amazing women, but I want to do something specifically female led about not necessarily problems, but just I think I want to do something female director, all of that malark, and because I'm craving that, and I haven't really done that since The Falling. And you know, I've worked this isn't me, you know, slanting any man that I've worked with. Every single man that I've worked with has been a delight, but there is obviously things that you come across on sets where you're like, huh, I wonder if it would be different if our story was about women's problems, not men's problems.
Completely.
I wonder if it would feel different if there was mainly women on this set. So I think for me, I'm really, I want to read something that excites me there. And I'm happy that I've kind of figured that out as well. Sometimes you don't realize what it is you want to do next. And you know, whether it'll be if you want to be a superhero or not or whatever, but sometimes you don't know why or what. So I'm happy that I kind of know that I need a break to just see some stuff.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, write Peaky Blinders, because that's going to take some time.
It's a great point, because different atmospheres and different relationships will draw different results. Yeah. And that's not an insult to any other atmospheres or relationships. Totally. But I saw a Ladybird recently.
Loved it.
And I think Dark River was a female director. Mm-hmm. A Ladybird's a great example of, there was nothing particular, or nothing I could put my finger on in that story that was new, or it was a coming of age story.
Yeah.
But there was just something about it that was just so beautiful. Yeah. And so the relationship between the mother and daughter and the relationships of everyone on screen just had something different. And it's because it was a female director and so many,
and it's coming from,
and writer, and so many people working on it, that
a woman's brain, a woman's perspective. And
people will panic and be like, well, it's not insulting men in any way.
I've done the projects I've done in the last year were so special to me and to everyone that I made them with. And every single male director or man on set were gorgeous, utterly gorgeous. Like, nothing ever bad happened. But you do realise that whether or not the director is gorgeous, it's coming from a point of view that is specifically male.
Yeah.
And that's totally fine and totally correct. And nothing about any of those were wrong or bad. But just like you said, watching Lady Bird, there was something, nothing was specifically different, but there was something different.
Yeah, completely.
And there was something, not even, I'm not going to say sensitive because that's a crap word, but just
something intimate.
Alive.
Yeah,
really awake, and the attention to different things. I think that's what was so special about it, is we are unfortunately so used to seeing things through a male's gaze or a male's, direction. And that's fine, because that's the way where we've come to now, and slowly things are starting to change. But something as simple as Lady Bird, where we all noticed that something was different.
Yeah.
And it's simply because it's coming from a different frame of mind. And that, to me, was so exciting. So, yeah, I want to do something like that. And I'm also aware that I need some time off.
Yeah.
And I also want to do some travelling. I know that sounds so ya-ya and so new, but I didn't do the gap year.
Yeah.
I kind of went straight from The Falling and just started working and doing bar jobs and working in my dad's cafe and stuff like that. So I didn't really get to go and see, oh, this sounds so crap, the world. I'm sorry.
It's true, and it's important for, again, what people forget, that any areas of the arts, again, they're still jobs and they're still work, and you need to reload and to re-energise that part of you that is excited and that's pushing all these performances and traveling and time off and things,
and
like
experience.
that's what re-energizes
experience
that.
What it is that you're supposed to be storytelling. I always find that so interesting when people ask me why I did something, or like, did you plan to do that in that scene? And it's like, no, I don't really like to plan anything, because realistically, do I really know what it's like to shoot a horse? No. So I may as well just leave it until I'm shooting the horse. Right. This is from Lady Macbeth, by the way.
Yeah. This isn't from the Gap
Year. This isn't from Gap Year. You know, I may as well just leave it to when I actually do it, because then I'll know how I feel. There's, as you said, there's only a certain amount of, you have to reload, you have to experience, you have to take things in, new things, and see different parts. So I think that's what I might go and do as well. Go and see some culture and eat some Greek salads.
Perfect. Well, I mean, I'll wrap things up there. And as much as no one, not many people, do what they do for awards, I do still think it's nice when something is credited. Because, again, particularly on a project where so many people have worked on it and the film is up for several BAFTAs.
I think awards are so necessary.
Yeah.
And I know that they're nothing. I know that it's a bit like this water bottle. I could take this home and pretend like it's an award and put it on my shelf, and it might get the same amount of respect that an award might.
Yeah, yeah.
If you don't really care that it's a water bottle or an award.
Yeah.
But, as you said, what it takes to get that film off the ground, and not even that you then get
from
that kind
everyone.
Of... But not even that you get a tick from someone, but that it's so rare in this industry that you give yourself a second.
Yeah.
And you're constantly moving on to the next thing and figuring out what you're doing next and who you're talking to next and when are you booked in June and all that stuff, that you sometimes forget to just go, wow, yeah, I made that film and that was really cool. And what we were saying at the beginning, you know, what's not interesting when you're doing it. And just actually saying congratulations. And what awards do is, it's not even that it matters if you don't get it or that you do, but that someone somewhere has said, you know what, we've seen your stuff and we're really impressed by you.
Yeah. Good work.
Yeah, well done. And that gives you a moment to smell the roses. My dad always says, stop.
Mm.
Give yourself a moment and just look at what you've done, because it's so easy to go, oh, I'm crap, I haven't done that much. And again, whatever.
It's natural to have that fear of, oh, this could end, I need to grab the next project and grab this and grab that. When, it's nice to have those bits to go, you know, that bit you did four projects ago that you've not thought about, that was really good. Yeah. Oh, wicked, thanks.
Yeah, also it brings... You know, it brings attention and light to little films like Lady Macbeth, again, which it's done really, really well, I'm aware, but having a BAFTA nod is pretty wicked. And it just means that people who haven't seen it or haven't heard it will go, oh, okay, I might go watch that film.
And just as importantly, it'll increase the likelihood of more films taking the risks it took and things like that, because that is the most heartbreaking part of the film industry in particular at the moment, is that you could make the best film ever, and if it doesn't get the backing and the push and the bums on seats, then see you later, it's gone kind of thing, which we should be. It's why whenever I'm pushing people to go and see films, it's generally independent films, because even if they're doing well, it's to say, look, studios can take risks on these films that put art before box office but are getting the box office as well, you know.
Yeah, and also just things like, you know, the fact that we were all unknowns. That shouldn't be such a conversation starter. No. Where else are unknown actors going to come from? Yep. Do you know what I mean? Like,
it's such an interesting one, because I saw a thing with James Gunn recently, and I loved James Gunn as a writer and director, and he was saying that often when he's casting, and again, it's the two viewpoints, which I think are perfectly valid. If he knows someone who's been killing it for years and never quite got what they deserve, he'll want them to get the role over someone who's just walked into the industry.
Yeah.
And that's completely right. Yeah. But it's that classic thing in any industry of, you need experience to get the good jobs, but you can't get experience if you don't get the job. So it's the balance of the two. It's becoming more and more of an obsession of mine of, like, I love the films where I don't know anyone in it, because you're just meeting the characters.
Yeah. And then every now and then you'll get a film that maybe can't quite afford the big times, and they give someone completely unknown an opportunity, and you make something magical, and then everyone goes, oh my God, why haven't we seen this girl before? And it's like, well,
that's why.
Yeah, that's why.
Well, thank you very thank much. You. I'll let you end lovely your day now. It's been a delight. And I'll see you on set of Peaky Blinders, the final season. See you later.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was episode 188. A very enjoyable conversation, I think you'll agree. And at no point did the tone betray the creepiness of the surroundings in a dark, a poorly lit hotel room in Soho. So thank you for tuning in. As I mentioned in the intro and in the podcast, I'd like you all to go and vote for the EE Rising Star. The votes are almost over, so swoop quickly. It's the BAFTAs, obviously. And yeah, I think Florence deserves that personally. But all joking aside, do vote for whoever you feel is appropriate. But I like these things. I like the ones that are open to public vote and people can interact and engage in. So yeah, hopefully you go and do that. I'll be back next week with more wonderful guests. Honestly, the lineup of guests this year is just getting more and more ridiculous. It's hit after hit after hit. Upcoming guests include Ruth Wilson, who is one of my favourite people, a dear friend, and happens to be one of the best actresses in the country. So that's good. I've got Greta Gerwig lined up, who's
only up for Oscars at the moment for Lady Bird, which is absolutely astounding film. Chris Ramsey, Steve McNeil from Go 8-Bit, just loads of really good people. Don Letts is lined up. So, yeah, loads of good guests to come. Check them all out. And as I said, go and peruse the back catalogue if you so fancy. I'm going to stop rambling now, and I'll see you all next week. Every Wednesday, you know what it is. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.